All right, let's begin. Today's cheer is generally sponsored by Dr. Bella Haas Weinberg to commemorate the yahrzeit site of her mother, Rosa Weissman Haas, Reisel bat Rabbi Shmuel Elimelech v'Sara alayha shalom, which will be on Yom HaShoah, which is Tuesday. And in that merit of Yom HaShoah, I also want to discuss, a little bit different than what we usually have done, but I want to discuss a tshuva, or two tshuvas, that appear in relationship to the Shoah that discuss something about the Holocaust, a question that came up in the Holocaust. And what we'll see through these two tshuvas discussions is not only a technical halachic question, which is itself somewhat enlightening, but really I think we'll get us a little bit of sense of the life, the people who went through the Holocaust and some of the real difficulties, the horrors that they went through. And hopefully, by learning some of this in their name, in their merit, we're able to bring some b'chut for them for what they did. So the discussion begins. The tshuvas are a set of tshuvas are written by Rabbi Yehoshua Moshe Aronson. Anyone know who that is? Rabbi Yehoshua Moshe Aronson was born in 1910 in Poland. He's from the Hasidim of Czakaszewer. Czakaszewer in Poland. He was one of those Hasidim there. He went to different yeshivas, and during the war, he ended up being sent in a few different concentration camps. He was at one point he was in Warsaw. At one point he was in Lodz. For a while he was in a concentration camp called Konin, which is not far from Warsaw, about I think 50 miles or so from Warsaw to the west. And at some later point he was sent to Auschwitz as well as to Buchenwald. And he ended up surviving the war, and the tshuvos that he wrote, both during the war as well as after the war, were later published, and they really tell not only the halachic story, but also he really much, very much wrote kind of like the way it transpired and the way people felt. And I think what we're going to really talk about today is not so much the halacha. We're really going to talk about the way that the emotional impact that these halacha might have had during these horrors that took place.
There's a book.
There's a few books. Yeah, this comes out from the book that was published after his p'tira, after he died in 1993. They published a work that collected all the various essays, and this book is called Alei Marorot, literally the leaves of bitterness. Yeah, and you can imagine why they're bitter. So I want to discuss the first tshuva we're going to read. It's a tshuva he wrote I actually don't know if there's a date for this, but it begins v'chaibem, they're right in the middle of that first page. And again, I know it's in Hebrew. I will translate everything we read. V'chaibem machilat treifot. Heyot shenimsu b'machane rabbanim v'talmidei chachamim hechel vikuach benogea lachilei tavshilei ha'treifot. Because in the camps, and I don't remember exactly the context, what camp he's talking about. I'm pretty sure he's talking about a concentration camp, not a death camp here. I think it's in Konin. But either way, I think that would apply equally probably in a death camp as well. A big debate started by these rabbis. They're in these concentration camps. There wasn't much food available, right? There was very, very little food available. And so the question became, can we start eating non-kosher food? Like, can we eat not just something which was cooked by a non-Jew, it might be somewhat problematic, something which is really treif, like it has, it has pork, it has, like, there's something really wrong with this food, we know it's problematic, can we eat it? Hayushi garsu, shirak im nechalash ad leafisat kochot mutar ye lechom min ha-treifot. Right, some argued that you're not allowed to eat it until you're actually weak. Right, here's the kind of the question. On the one hand, it's clear that's the karat nefashot, zdoche, all the mitzvot, pretty much except for a few exceptions, right? Everything pretty much is overridden if your life is at stake. So if you're deathly ill, of course you're allowed to eat, even pork or some other non-kosher food. The question is, these particular individuals at this time, they're not eating well, right? They're kind of emaciated, but they're surviving. They're lasting. And so the question was, in this particular predicament, are we allowed to eat treifot? Are we allowed to eat non-kosher food? Because right now, I'm okay. I'm not doing well, but I'm not sick, right? Can I eat the food knowing that, if I don't eat it, eventually I might become sick, or there's a good probability that I will become sick? So that was the question. And I want to be clear here. The question here is not simply a question of, halacha, how do we interpret, the halacha here, but it's also a little bit about, like, the kishkas of being a frum Jew. Right, I think we have a sense of, like, being a frum Jew, like, you don't eat pork. That's something that just feels so repulsive to you. So if you're forced to eat it, that's one thing. But if you don't feel forced to it, I think we really sense that sense that, like, you know, that reason, that urgency of I don't want to eat something that feels so repulsive to me. This is part of my identity, right? So much of who I am has been taken away from me, you know, by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. Like, so much has been taken away. The very least I want to do is kind of keep that part of my identity. So I think we really sense, you know, part of that tension here.
This is what Yechiel alluded to yesterday in the Mincha Shir about what was the definition of Kiddush Hashem. Do you do anything possible? Do you do anything possible to remain a Yehudi? Or do you do anything possible to, you know, to stay alive and Kiddush HaChayim, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
If I were doing the post, like, I would say you should eat as much as you can, because right now you're already wasting away, and it's more likely you'll get, if you get sick, you'll die.
I'm glad I wasn't at this argument.
And not only that, but it'll speed up your death if you don't eat. So for all those reasons, if I was Paschal, I would say it's pekuach nefesh and shidduch.
For sure. From a medicinal perspective, it also kind of
speaks. I'm not going to die today or tomorrow.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, we're not, I'll read his answer and I'll talk about it, but I think it's pretty clear for most post-game that, I mean, how you define exactly preventative medicine is like an interesting question in of itself, but certainly something like this is not just preventative, this is, you know, it's a kind of nefashot.
So it's the setting you're in, you're with so many other people, it's crowded, you have no sewage, there's no...
It's also hard to, I mean, like, I think, that's why I kind of want to emphasize that I think part of this is not just, like, the technical question, it's really about the kishkas, you know, literally the kishkas, of, like, how do you feel as a Jew, you know, eating non-kosher food? And not only that, but also it's, you know, I guess we'll see this in the next tshuva, but in retrospect, we know what happened in the Holocaust. Like, we know the horrors that they went through, and, you know, when they were in camp in Conan, right, it only even get worse.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily know that. They still think, you know, oh, the Germans are just, you know, keeping us in a ghetto, but it's not going to, you know, lead to something, you know, much worse.
I know, but there was no menu. It was either eating or not.
Yeah. I just think it's in terms of judging. In terms of judging, it's just a little bit harder to... In terms of that perspective, I think it's important to realize, like, you know, they might not feel that we're in a pikuach nefesh situation. Like, we can make it out. Like, I can last another year, you know, before we get saved by, I don't know, the Germans are, you know, change their mind about how they treat the Jews, or, you know, something happens, right? That might have been their mentality. So this is what he did, and this is a really pastoral, I think, point, not just a psak, but he says as follows. Savur ha'yiti she'hayot she'adavar karuch b'sakanat nefashot, as I felt very strongly that this was a matter of life and death, chayav kol echad lechol miyad v'lo lechakot yisiyat neshama, everyone is obligated, not just allowed to, but obligated to eat immediately and to not wait for a moment where it will become weakened and become, you know, life-threatening. And here's where he becomes almost a pastoral rabbi, not just a psak. When I saw that despite my public psak, nonetheless, there were a number of people who were uncertain, they weren't comfortable following it. So what did I do? I took a spoonful of treif soup that probably had, you know, I don't know exactly what, some, I don't think they had so much meat, but probably some amount of, like, treif, whatever, pork or something in there. And I made a bracha out loud, right, in front of everyone. Shakol nye bidvaro. Right, baruch atah Hashem olkim ha'olam, shakol nye bidvaro ve'achalti. And I ate the soup. Now, you're going to explain, there happens to be an interesting question about making brachot. Right, one question is about eating, another question is about making brachot. I'll skip to the end kind of the discussion. The short of it is, there is a discussion in the Machloket Rishonim about whether or not if you're eating non-kosher food, should you make a bracha on it. We paskin, this is paskin the Shulchan Aruch and Simon Kuf Tzadi Dalet, that you do not make a bracha. If you decide you want to go to McDonald's because that's what you want to do, don't make a bracha on it because it's considered to be repulsive to God to make a bracha on something that is forbidden. But if you need to eat it because it's necessary medicinally, because there are no alternative foods, then you should make a bracha on that food. That's why the Shulchan Aruch paskin and Reish Dalet. So if you need the food, then definitely should make a bracha, and this is what he does. And then he explains, not only did I make a bracha, which is the technically halachic, correct halacha, but I also want to explain to people, you know, what does the bracha mean to us, right? How are you making a bracha in these like horrors in the ghetto, right? How are you possibly making a bracha of thanking God for like having to eat tray food in this horrible situation? So he explained to them, this is what I have in mind when I make this bracha. I explained to those who were surrounding me that the meaning of the bracha, that everything that transpires onto us, everything that happens, all of it comes from God. All of it is from Kadosh Baruch Hu. And we are obligated, because of a Kadosh Baruch Hu's wishes, to do the utmost we can to survive and to persist. And my words were, you know, somewhat convincing, influential, and many end up indeed surviving by eating this soup. So I think we get a sense a little bit from this tshuva of not just the halacha, but also the sense of the, you know, the difficulty, the emotional difficulty, the spiritual difficulties that really transpired in the camps. And, you know, I think we're all pretty knowledgeable about what happened in the Holocaust, so I don't want to go through the details, but I think we kind of get a sense of the, you know, the flavoring, or the lack of flavor, you know, as it is here of the, you know, in this situation. Any comments so far?
It's a hard question to ask, but isn't it preferable halachically to eat a dead body of a person than of a pig?
Yeah, classic debate. Is it better to eat cannibalism? I think it's a big debate. It's not so obvious. This is in Yeshivat Har Etzion at Gush, my yeshiva, there was a big debate between two of the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital, which was better. Rav Lichtenstein said, technically, on a halachic level, cannibalism is less of a prohibition than eating treif. On the other hand, Rav Amital said, yeah, but like based on like a more basic moral, you know, worldview, like eating a person is like the worst offense you could possibly do. That's certainly much worse. So it's like a classic debate they had. I mean, hopefully we never have to have this debate. This is very much, you know, hopefully only theoretical.
Well, think about it in the concentration scholastic. If somebody dropped dead, you weren't going to eat them raw. So you're going to do cook them. They're not going to let you cook them. They're going to take the guy out and burn them.
Yeah, also the person's like, probably diseased.
There's really no choice to eat.
Honestly, there are probably a lot of diseases. You don't want to. Yeah, it's so, probably not.
Well,
cook
them. You cook them. Cook them. Boil with
them. Yeah. I think these type of questions are, you know, they're somewhat easier to talk about now, although some of us are still eating. But I think for most of us, it's, you know, these questions are very difficult questions.
I mean, people did it in the Chorban.
Women
did it in the Pyrenees Mountains.
What?
They did it in the Pyrenees Mountains with plane crashes. You know,
they
had no place to go.
Yeah, it happened.
Tell us if you like it.
I don't think anyone really likes it. Okay, I want to turn the next page. So that's tshuva number one. I'm not sure when this was written. I mean, all these tshuvas were rewritten after the Holocaust. I'm not sure exactly what year that first tshuva was. But the second tshuva, I think, is really interesting because it brings kind of a, I guess, like a contrasting perspective. And it's based on a story. He tells as follows. Din Torah be Auschwitz. It refers to a Din Torah that happened in the camp in Auschwitz. What's the story? So it begins, actually, this is an interview that someone, I'm not sure, I guess something Eifshitz, Rita Eifshitz, interviewed Rabbi Yoshua Aronson at some point after the war. And it's kind of the beginning kind of tells the story of this interview. Mizman rasiti lidvada el ish ha-muflaze, ela she'advar lo nistayeli. For much time, I wanted to interview this, you know, giant in Torah, and I didn't get the opportunity. Uka'et, and now at this time, bevoi lotzi le'or asufat yodot shel makdishei Hashem b'machodot hashmada, ichlati lirayen oto et Rav Aronson. And now I'm publishing this work, I'm publishing this essay on the testimonies of many of those people who survived the Holocaust, and so I want to interview him. And so I'm listening, I'm talking to him in front of him, and I'm listening to him. And this is the conversation we had. This is my question, meaning the interviewer. What was the worth of performing mitzvot in the death camps? Right, not just the halachic worth, but what was the emotional worth? Like, how did that affect you? So he responds, Atasho Eloti, you're asking me about the worth of halachic things. Omeli Rav, Aronson Birchuz Rav, he says to me, Kishikamat Amok min Maked min Tchol Lamdani, like a big wrinkle appears in his forehead. Be'emet kashe me'od la'ashiv la'sheila. This is a very difficult question to respond to. Habev Esaper Lachasipur. I'm going to tell you over a story that depicts a little bit of some of the of this, this difficulty. Sipur me'od me'anyen, kisherega ani niskar bo l'cho pratav. A story that's very interesting, that I remember at this moment all of its details. U'bemet, and he mentions that on the side, atan nochach ladat sh'rav amnam zocher et ha'sipur. And you should know, the Rav here, Rav Aronson, really did remember the story, ma'amash ma'zocher, what do you mean by remember? Ki'ilu ha'davar karav itrachesh rak etmol. He remembered like all the details of the story as if it happened just yesterday. So he had this, you know, not just he had a phenomenal memory, I think it's really that the story was just so, you know, traumatic and was so such an eventful moment in his life that he really had every single detail. As an aside, or as an intro, the author here, of Eifshitz, describes the following just detail that I think most many of us probably know, but just is worth knowing. Tzarich le'avchin ben Auschwitz ben Buna Auschwitz. You have to differentiate between the different parts of Auschwitz. Auschwitz had a number of sub-camps. There was called Auschwitz 1, Auschwitz 2, Auschwitz 3. They had different names to them. And b'tchumi ha'gehenom hazeh, Auschwitz hayu kama modulim. Ki al mul misrfot u'mitkinei ha'gtai ha'gazim l'shmarat ha'monit shel revavot b'nei adam b'yamama achat. Because next to the gas chambers, which were primarily in Auschwitz 1 and 2, I believe, that killed, you know, thousands and millions of Jews. Next to them, hitkaimu b'miskeret machane atzum meimadim shel sandot anak. Next to them, there were also various factories or industrial productions that were nearby. Asher achadim b'palei ha'tasiyat chashuvim b'garmani ukmu v'felusham. That several of the most important industrialists of the German industry established factories there. B'matara d'natzel et koach adam shel hanidonim l'mavet, to be able to profit off of the free labor of the Jews who, anyways, were destined to be killed. Right, we know this pretty well. And Nishem Nitzolzen Erchu to Lexiot and Madura Nazit, in order to fulfill this need, they would have these selections. I think we're you know, all kind of aware of these selections. Totzaita Shikola Khalashim, Rabot Ahiladim, Vechalkama Machreshlanashim, Vezekenim Nishlechoy Ashala Kapshanim. The result of these selections was that majority of the young people, as well as the weak and elderly, and the women were sent immediately to the gas chambers. Ve'elu ha'gvarim ha'tzirim, and it was the, you know, the strong, well-to-do men. Ve'chol eila mustugalim la'avod, hukhnasu b'tzrifim b'chalko ha'acher shel Auschwitz ha'nikra Buna. And everyone else, everyone who was strong and able to work, was sent to the bunkers in Buna Auschwitz, what's also called as Auschwitz 3. There's a third name, I'm forgetting what it's called, but either way, this was where, this was the work camps, you know, adjacent to Auschwitz, and the conditions were not much better, but they did, you know, survive. So he indeed was selected to be put into Buna Auschwitz. He did survive the war, and he survived Auschwitz by being selected indeed. And he tells the following story that happened while I was in these barracks. So after this introduction, you can understand the story. So he tells the following story. This took place, and this is remarkable that he remembers when it took place. It took place sometime in Sivan of 1944. So it says like May of 44, right, which is near the end of the war. This is actually after,
you're away.
This is a year away from D-Day, but it's after it's actually close to D-Day, but it's, you know, it's pretty close to when they end the war. But this is actually when Auschwitz really heated up in the literal sense with this is when they end up killing, you know, thousands of people daily. At that time, I had already been appointed as one of the elders, like the, you know, more respected individuals in Buna Auschwitz. There was a voice that came out in the camp that the Maidarim came. I didn't know what Maidarim referred to. Amim rabim shvatim ve'idu tikam lo yudim hegiu l'Auschwitz. There were so many people who came to Auschwitz, even non-Jews, right? All sorts of people from different places of life. Nubechein hegia od eze shevet shekorim lahem Maidarim. And another group of individuals who were called Maidarim came to camp. Ulam litanmati harbe nuchachti lada shekavna la yudim yotze Hungaria. I found out at some point what did people refer to with this, nickname of Maidarim?
Yes, Maidarim.
Maidarim, okay. Okay, thank you.
That's his gentleman.
What's the meaning of Majorim?
It means Hungarian.
Okay, so these ended up being Hungarians. Indeed, Achinu, Bsarenu, Yudim, Tmimim, Yudim, Charedim, Udvar Hashem, Ubenem, Gamar Betam, Necham, Uvakim. These are our brothers, our soulmates, Tamim Jews, our Jews who are fearful of the word of God, people who are from Erlchin Jews, and amongst them were many Tamid Chachamim. And if you know your, basic Holocaust history, you know that the large majority of Hungarian Jews were sent straight to the gas chambers. And there were, I think on average, they say close to 10,000 were gassed a day almost by the end of the war. So this was like a really large amount that arrived in Auschwitz, and they really,
But they were like the last Jews that got sent.
Yeah.
So they had a good comparatively for the first 3-4 years.
But they, it was, but many of the Hungarian Jews were wiped out very quickly. It was, really.
My friend's father managed to get into a slave labor camp, so he survived, but he was taken from there.
One of the lucky ones, if you can say that, okay, so this is obviously very difficult things to read through, but I'm, I'm going to move on because it's, The thing that really characterized the Jews from Hungary was their simplicity, a little bit their naivete. Maybe part of this, naivete was like their basic, that was kind of like who they were. But me, who I had already gone through the seven, gates of hell, I'd already gone through this, all these different, I'd really seen the Holocaust through many different layers, this, simplicity they had, this attitude they had, seemed to me very strange and, off. And he actually describes part of this sentiment. Ubechein, ikarti aus be'Auschwitz asir echad. And it was at this time, some point, I guess, in May or June of 44, I met a particular captive, a particular Jew. Miyadim bo'o reiti shu tamin chacham gadol. And I right away realized that this individual was a big tamin chacham. Hayudi hazeh goresh le'Auschwitz yachad im shnei banav atzirim b'achorei chemet. This individual was sent to Auschwitz together with his two young boys. Bikitzur histaver shehu haya rabah shel kila kedosha vaitiska v'sham mishpachto haya rota rotha. This individual was
Roth.
Yeah.
That's how
this one. Yeah, Roth. So this individual was Rabbi Roth from the community of Vaitiska. Everybody knows where that is. I think it's in somewhere in Hungary. Bishmo apratin eni yachol lizaker mar aronson be'etsev ma. He says, unfortunately, I can't remember his first name, but I remember his name was Rabbi Roth. And litim krovot shochachti marav b'nei alacha b'divrei Torah. And many times during the bunkers, we would talk and we would shmooze and we would talk some Torah during in the camp. Hidrashamti meod migodol b'kiuto v'dvikuto b'limud Torah. And I was really impressed by his not only his knowledge of Torah but also by his fervor for Torah. His real he really loved Torah. Ulam b'devar echad lo yacholti lazizo midato. But there was one thing that I wasn't able to convince him. V'hu shemachaneh Auschwitz hu machaneh shmada. I couldn't convince him that Auschwitz was a death camp. Harav hatamim mevaitiska hemin kmo rabim mimegashei Hungaria shenishotem viladeyam shufrudumehem mitzayim b'kein machaneh avra. He was naive. Individual felt, like many of the others who were sent from Hungary, that their wives and their children, they had been sent not to, the gas chambers, but they had been sent to some type of convalescent,
health camp.
And there they were, benefiting from, fresh air and good quality, conditions. And in addition, what they would do is they also would work, like the families would be working, to whatever degree they could. Apparently they would even, the Nazis would have them write, fake, as we know, like report cards as to how well these children and the wives were working, and they would give them to the male, their husbands, you know, or their fathers, and tell them, oh, look, your son is working so well, you know, he got like 3 stars today. Even though we know, you know, obviously it was a lie and the son had been, you know, been killed. But this is like the extent of their lie, obviously with the intention of this was going to motivate the Jews to work better, the ones who had survived. But it's, you know, really horrible. And the Jews from Hungary were, you know, naively believed them. They would give them points. So I really tried convincing him that these were all, you know, words made up. This was a lie.
It's so impressive how they're so designed that they're so smart in how to fake everything.
Yeah, yeah. It's a psychological term.
Yeah, no, this was really, I mean, I actually did not know this part. This is really...
Just,
Nobody ever accused Germans of being
dumb.
It's
not chaos.
Evil, maybe.
Very well thought out.
Yeah.
Fake report cards.
Yeah, absolutely. This is, you know, this is horrible. This is, you know, really, it kind of tells us the extent of this. Yeah, it really tells us the extent of... Here, pass the... Okay, so he continues the story. He says as follows. We're on page 336, I think it's the third page. He says as follows. So I tried convincing him. Nisiti lasbir lo tamet tamar. I really tried convincing him of this horrible truth. Amarti lo ki mutav avien heg b'tzurah chaschonit b'chokotav. And I told him, this is very practical, I said, it's also worthwhile that you act in a way that you preserve your strength, right? Keep your strength, because this has, you know, been going on for a while. He's been in the camp, I think, for several years already. He knows you need to keep your strength the best you can. Because it was known, and this is certainly this individual, the Hungarians were very hard workers. And so whenever a task was given to them, they would work, you know, as hard as possible. Probably because they also felt that, you know, this was my work ethic. And if I work well, maybe it'll, you know, do well for my children or my wife, you know, my wife, who is in, you know, the other convalescent camp. So we told them, so you should try preserving your health as best as possible and, you know, moderate yourself, you know, in order to keep, you know, healthy as much as you can. So I told him, and maybe that way he'd be able to, you know, stay alive longer. This rabbi did not believe me. He didn't take my word seriously. Instead, he thought I was, you know, crazy. I was saying this, you know, heresy. It took them a lot of time until they finally understood that I was, unfortunately, telling the truth. And in the meanwhile, until this took place, until they finally understood the reality of the situation, this particular individual and many of the Hungarian Jews, their health became, you know, slowly worse or quickly, you know, worsened and worsened, really diminished quickly. And this individual, he was no longer capable of really surviving in the horrible conditions that existed in Auschwitz. So one evening, I don't know how long it says later, maybe a month or two later, you know, sometime in July, August of 44, this individual comes up to me, his legs are inflamed, his body's all inflamed, his legs are full of different wounds, and it's swollen and full of different wounds and scabs. Vehu Omer Locheshli, he quietly whispers to me, Hu Margishi Kochotav Holchim. He feels that his strength is waning and that he is going to die. Vekhilim Uvadai Shilo Yachzik Mamad Odzman Rav, he's not going to last long. Ulai Omer Miyodea Rav Roth Uchal Azorlo Bemashu Leislo. And he says to me, maybe I'll be able to help him in some way. And Rav Aronson responds to him. He says, you know, this telling over the story, Lazorlo, help him. Mechayeich Harav Aronson Agmimut, I smiling in a, you know, like a horrible smile. Makvar Yacholti Lazorlo, how can I help him? Bekoshi Girarti et Shtei Raglai Nufchot V'Rakim Matz Rav Yitzachli Tapeset Al dargashti. I could barely help myself, right? In this camp, and we know actually in Buna, Auschwitz, Primo Levi and Elie Wiesel, you know, many of the famous authors were in the same camp, and you can see reading the writings, they barely survived themselves. It was, you know, almost everyone obviously cared for each other, but it was very much you got to take care of yourself first. You know, put your air mask on yourself before you help, you know, your children. And this was very much true in the camp. It was almost impossible to help others. And he says, I could barely even lift myself up every night, you know, onto my bunker, right, onto my bunk. Like, it was just so hard for me to even get myself up. How could I help someone else? Nonetheless, v'kach v'shichvi al dargashti, and here was, as I was relying on my bunk, bijuk nichnas hakapo shel komando hadasa. At that particular moment, the head, like the Jewish head, of the engineering group, right, of for Jews, came into the bunks. Hayaze bakur lichanchi. This was an lichansi. He was this individual from Lichansk. I think it's somewhere in Lithuania. L'sheavar avrei chasidi, haya pam bachur yeshiva. And this individual was, you know, at one point he was a bachur yeshiva, right? He was pretty young, but he at one point was a from Jew who was a chasid, right? He had come from a religious background. Ha-kapo hazeh haya noheg likanes leitim krevot leblok shelanu. And this kapo would regularly come into our bunk, to our barracks. Ho-evi tamid mashu lekor mishpachto, and he would bring some food to his relatives, Rav Chaim Moshe Lontol Hradmav, Beno Shel HaGaon HaBeitin Uni VeChono Shel Rav Modrik, he'd bring to his relatives. V'hinei kasher nichnas l'kapo hazeh, hivzik v'mochi rayon. At that particular moment, as he comes in to the bunker, I have an idea. Kilu zimnu li et machshava min hashamayim. And I have an idea, almost pops in from God. Komando hadasa. So I speak to him and I ask him. Hayta achat ha-machlakot ha-tovot b'yoter b'Auschwitz. It was well known that the engineering corps was one of the best working groups that you could be in Auschwitz. Avdu ba b'sach ha-kol 18 ish. There were 18 men in the engineers. Hein bisu avodot miuchadot avur ha-SS. And they would do special work for the SS. And because the work was specialized, they would be well rewarded for their work, or relatively, if you can say that, well rewarded. Avdu b'tocha rak anashim balei intelligentsia v'yeda techni hadasa, and only individuals who had the necessary background, had, you know, the engineering background, were able to work as part of this group. Ucha ochel haya lekamando ze b'shefa. There was much food, and this is obviously relative, for these individuals. Ubechein ka'amur ne'natli b'hayrayon, and so I had this idea. Madua lo enased lenatel za kapo kudei mishtadel avur harav hazeh v'ulai b'rsot Hashem gam matzliach v'imsima zu. So I go over to this kapo and I said, maybe he's going to be able to help this, you know, poor Jew from Hungary, this Nebuch, you know, simple Yid, who, naive Jew, maybe he'll be able to help him. Karati le kapo v'hu yikarev al dargashti. So I call him over and he comes over to my bunk. And you can really hear that. He's not even getting up. Like, he can barely move. This rabbi, he's, you know, calling him over like, please walk over to me. And as he's walking, he's kind of like, he's showing off a little bit. His like clean robes, like his nice uniform, his press uniform. Benigud, and he comments, Rav Aronson, this is in contrast to the rags that were, shmatas, you know, these rags that were torn, that we, the simple, prisoners would be wearing. Ve'amartilo, and I said the following thing to this commando, to this, to this head of the, to this kapo, the head of the engineering corps. Lamata pam yishkone lamo b'sha'achat. Have you ever heard the expression that you can buy Olam Haba in 1 minute, that with one simple task, you can, you know, buy yourself Olam Haba?
Yeah, that's used Rabbi Akiva's executioner.
Rabbi mentions it in the Avodah Zarah, a few different places. There are a number of places where it's an expression of, you know, one act that can really, you know, change a life. So I told him as follows. Siparti lo al matzavo hakashev v'anu'ash del Rav Roth mi-Hungaria. I told him about this, you know, horrible situation that Rav Roth was in. She'oved ba'achat ha-komandat ha-kashot b'yoter. And this individual was unfortunately assigned to one of the worst working groups. He had been assigned to schivat avanim, to carrying stones, right? Like some type of masonry, which you can imagine is, you know, really hard work of schlepping stones from one place to another. It's heavy, breaks your back. especially when you have no strength, is one of the worst assignments you can possibly have received. And it was clear to me that this individual, he was not going to survive, not just we're not talking weeks, he wouldn't survive days, right? He really was at the end. Amarti la capo, I asked this capo, ulai zachiti, zachita, v'nitmita li mistrazo, ach v'rach b'yitei shituchal lazor la yudi hazeh. You know, evoking the story of Esther, maybe you received this position in order to be able to save this Jew. V'lo nefesh achat hamatzil, and you should know, not only are you saving one individual, but in fact you are saving three. Ela shalosh nefashot. By saving the father, you'll be able to save also the children, right? The children will be inspired by the father, will be able to help them, have the strength to help them, right? It's not just one individual, it's really a family of people you'll be able to save. So he asked, make this request, it's a very difficult request. You can imagine the, you know, hesitation on the part of this, you know, individual. On the one hand, he obviously wants to save others, but on the other hand, you know, this is every man for himself. This is very much a death situation. If the Nazis discover this individual, this Hungarian, does not have the requisite, you know, background, not only will he die, but, you know, the couple will probably die, lose his position, and be sent right away to the gas chamber. So you can imagine the predicament he's in. So he thinks for a long time. Zman Rab, he says the capo, he really takes his time, he thinks about it. Hitatef ishtika, ulbasof amar, tov, ani muchal nistaken. He says, finally at the end, I agree, I am willing to risk my life for this individual. Machar ani mavir tarav el hakamando hadasah sheli. Tomorrow I'm going to bring in the papers and have him transferred to my unit, to the engineering corps. Avru kam yamim v'arav mivataisga hit oshesh. Several days passed, and all of a sudden I saw, to my great relief, that this Rabbi Roth, was in fact becoming better. He in fact was healing. Mamash neniti liroto. I really was, deriving some pleasure from seeing the kishumi chazek mavrim yom liyom, that he's getting healthier every day. Me'az yitchil avod bekamando hadasa kilu nolad mechadash. It's almost as if he was born anew, right? It's almost like this. He was finally given this new strength. Gam mareach chitzonishtana, not just his, you know, persona, his attitude, but even his outer appearance was becoming better. He almost looked like he was a healthy individual, like he, you know, was pre-war, if you could say that. Not only was he himself getting healthier, but the Rav's children, right, these two young boys, were also becoming healthier because not only was he able to get better food for himself, but he was able to sneak out better food for his children. Particularly, he was giving them the soup, which was also given to the actual SS officers. Yeah. Right, so this isn't just, you know, bad soup that was left over for the Jews. It was actually quality soup that the SS officers, you know, were receiving. I don't know how great the soup was, you know, during the war at 94, in 44, but at this point, but it's, you know, it certainly was a lot healthier and more substantive than whatever the Jews were receiving. And so everyone's becoming healthier. Is it kosher? No. This is why the question is going to come up. Here's how the story continues. And the story gets actually kind of crazy, but it really kind of shows you the, you know, the craziness of the situation. He comments that at this time, you know, during these days, these first, you know, week or so, I really had like a lot of sipuk nefesh. I really, you know, gained a lot of happiness, satisfaction from seeing them, these individuals, right? Knowing the fact that I contributed in some way to their survival, right? I was part of this mitzvah, and I really felt better about myself, which we know, you know, surviving the Holocaust was as much about the psychology of being able to, you know, have the right attitude. This is very much like Viktor Frankl's perspective. It's very much about your psychology as much as it was about the physical, you know, dire straits that you were in. And so he said, like, this really gave me some type of chizuk, that I, you know, I was really receiving some type of hana, this benefit from this situation. V'hine, erev echad b'chozrim avodati, ayef, kashush v'atzutz, One evening, I returned back from work, and I was exhausted, I was tired, I was, you know, torn up. Amar li yidid echad, one of my friends came over to me and said, Hakapo shel kamando adasah chipes otcha b'inyan dachkuf. This kapo, this the head of the engineering corps, he is desperately looking for you. He's looking for you with a very weighty matter, it's very pressing matter. Ulepeta hiperetz habachur halinchansi hakapo hanal, v'uko kulot so'er v'kotsef. And immediately at some point, this kapo emerges and he is, you know, up in a whirl. He's storming, he's excited. There's some type of thing, he's very agitated. Af pam lo ra'iti oto kol kach rogesh v'zo'em. I had yet to see him so emotional and so fiery. At first, you can kind of get, he's really trying to, explaining the situation. At first, I couldn't even understand what he was saying. He was just so fiery and so, you know, discombobulated that you couldn't understand what he was even trying to say. At finally, at some point, I understood what he was trying to get at. In the short of it was, he wanted a din Torah. He wanted a judgment, right, and adjudication. Who tovea l'din Torah to Rav Roth. He wants a din Torah from Rabbi Roth. Lama ve'alma. So I responded to him, why? Why do you want a din Torah? Heshivlu akapo b'rticha gedola. He responded to me with his anger, his, you know, frustration. U'bechein ani lakach d'atmi sikun kavod v'rav. Kaved v'rav. I took upon myself this real serious danger by accepting him into this, you know, by lying and accepting him into the engineering corps. And why did I do this? Why did I, you know, take this risk? In order so that I could have a word to say to God, that in the world to come, in the world of the truth, I could say to my Creator, and who knows as well as I do, that indeed we are at any moment going to reach the, you know, the next world to come, right? Our lives are always, you know, in danger. And I thought, Lavov Lamar, Yitzalti Nevesh Mitzrael, I'd be able to come and say to my Creator, I have some merit, I saved a Jewish soul. Yitzalti Rav Gadol Batorah, I saved a, you know, a rabbi. Asiti Masha Asiti, Stakanti B'chol Sakanot, Kilila Tziloshi, Yishar B'chayim, V'abit Torah Barabim. I did all I could so that he could survive the war and he'd be able to spread his Torah to others. And what is he doing? V'harav Shalani Mahu Oseh, how is he reacting to this, you know, this risk that I take in this great kindness, himshich akapo me'az shenitkabel lekamando adasa, since he has been accepted to this, you know, engineering corps, he speak legamre lechol min amarak hamazin shel mitbach ha'eses. He has stopped eating the soup. He stopped eating the food that the SS provided. Hatreif, because it is treif, because it is not kosher. Rehu mitkayem rak al pristot lechem yivisha. And he is subsisting solely on the dry bread that they are providing, not on the more healthy and substantive treif soup.
He was bringing the treif soup to his children.
He was bringing the treif soup to his children, but he himself is not eating the treif soup. The imlo yochal treif huyamut maher, and so this kapo is, you know, very angry, very upset, because he's saying without eating the soup, this individual, he's going to die very quickly. If he's going to die, right, if he doesn't care about his own life, right, he's not willing to put in the effort to survive, why am I, you know, putting some, you know, my skin out? Why am I, you know, taking this risk if he's not willing to, you know, survive himself? Right? Why am I taking this risk? I took a simple prisoner and I pretended, I lied, said that he was an engineer. Bechol ofen lo asiti zol kedei shu yigava mirav v'yamut. I certainly did not do this in order that he would die from hunger. Lo bishvil zeh ani mistaken, ani minyan bekach. I am not interested. I did not take this risk in order for him to die.
He's also taking the place of somebody else who could
have. He's also taking the place of someone else. Yes, absolutely. He doesn't even mention that, but yes, that is true. As he mentioned, there were only 18 slots. There was a very much limited number. Lor kol zeh.
High slots.
The oracle says, "Sikei makapo." Because of all this, this kapo says, "Higati liyadi chata sofit shimarav lo yamod iti ledin Torah machar baboker ani machzor lekamando hevos shelo." So he said, very fiery, very angrily, if he's not willing to sit in the Din Torah to have an adjudication, to really discuss this issue, you know, to judge the issue, I am going to return him tomorrow morning to the stone schleppers. I'm sure there's a better word, but the people who have to carry the heavy rocks. Nisiti, so what is this Rav Aronson says, right? He's trying to calm him down. This guy's obviously very angry, and you can imagine, you know, in dire straits, people are, tensions are flaring, people have, you know, it's a very stressful situation. So he's trying to de-escalate the situation, calm him down. I try explaining to him, you know, how crazy it is to have a Din Torah, right, in Auschwitz. Like, that's an insane proposition. Here, in this death camp, you're going to have a Din Torah, right? Who can think of a Din Torah in Auschwitz? Amarti lo b'genom zeh shel Auschwitz, u'bichlal ulai b'chol zot tevater al dishatcha. Maybe you're willing to, you know, be mochel, to, you know, forgive or to, you know, not, you know, press ahead in this request. Lechriach rav gadol v'tor sheyochal treifot, to ask of a big rabbi that he eats treif food. Kol shiduli v'chol koach yashichnua shili lo hizizi etzakapa miryashto achat din Torah. And yet, nonetheless, despite all of my efforts, I wasn't able to convince him to not have a Din Torah. He was insistent that there would be a Din Torah.
Even the request of a Din Torah is so, I mean, for this person, it's so honorable in a way.
Yeah, in some ways it is honorable. I mean,
you have a Din Torah, just get the guy out of there.
Yeah, screw it. I think we certainly can feel, you know, I certainly, you know, certainly feel bad for this.
If he has a Din Torah that goes against the capo, he's going to have to abide by that.
Yeah, I think
you've just done it. No, tell me if I can.
I think we certainly see, I mean, I think the word capo, especially in modern sense, often has like a more negative association because we know of, unfortunately, many capos betrayed, you know, their fellow Jews. I think this capo, you see, you know, really did try his best, and you know, he certainly
one of the leaders.
Yeah, and he certainly was a tzaddik in some ways, you know, sticking out his own neck in order to save this individual, and he is willing to take, you know, have a Din Torah.
Background, you read at the beginning.
Yeah, he did, and he was a Bachur Yeshiva, but you know, still, this is a real risk. I don't know, I'll be honest, I don't know if I would be willing to take it myself. This is a. You know, I don't know if this was, you know, we certainly can't judge in that situation. Lebasof, kishara'iti, she'ein manos mikach, be'ein b'ri acheret, when I saw that there was no escaping this, there was no other choice, u'biyadua ki hu alul chas v'shalom, mekayimet imu lechzir et harav rata shel kamando memenu hu ba, ve'ilatzti lechnea, lekana, lekayimet din ha'torah etzli al hadargash. So I decided, I was convinced that indeed we're going to have a Din Torah, and where this Din Torah take place, not in some respectful courtroom, it's going to take place literally on my bunk, right? I am in the, and we all know like the bunks look like, right? You see the, you see the, you know, the emaciated, you know, three or four individuals all on one small, you know, little smaller than a twin bed. Everyone's staying there. He's like literally, you know, lying on bed, emaciated, you know, barely surviving, and he's listening to a Din Torah, right? Almost this absurd situation. So this is what happened. Commander Chazal, to you know, this capo, you know, repeated. This is the way Din Torah works. Every Din Torah, if you know Din Torah, the basic rules, you have to, you know, state the entire claim in front of both litigants. So the capo repeats his claim in front of his, you know, litigant, in front of the fellow litigant, in front of the Rabbi Roth. So he's telling over the story, I, you know, risked my life in order to save this Jew, Yudi Chai, klamar shielo sikun lisher b'chayim, and I did it in order that this individual will survive. Asher yabit Torah barbim b'Yisrael, ani osezot latzil nefesh m'Yisrael, kidei zalakot al yidei zech b'chelek ha'olam haba. I did all of this in order that this individual would survive and, or to, you know, give me some merit in the next world. Amar ulam me'achar v'arav hazem minazer me'achilat treif v'lachein in lo kol sikul lishe'er b'chayim. However, because this individual is refusing to eat the treif, more substantive soup, and is going to therefore die, ein ani rotzei lisoken l'mano, I therefore do not want to risk my own life to save him. V'lachein yish b'dati hechel mimachar l'achikom me'akomando ha'minyuchesed sheli. And therefore, my intention is to return him, not, you know, in a week from now, but turn him tomorrow back to where he came from, back to the stone schleppers. Divrei Harav hayu ksarim betachlit. So the response by Roth was short and to the point. Hu einel mistaken klal. He is not risking his life. Briyoto hi tova ke'et ve'ochel hachasher maspik lo bechlet. The kosher food, right, the dry bread, was sufficient for him. Yesh lo maspik lechem. He had enough bread. Kimat chasi kilo layom, almost half a kilo, which is, you know, not a ton of bread, but I guess you can certainly survive relative to the...
It's a pound.
The pound of bread. It's not a crazy amount. Of, it's not that. One bread a day. It's not that much. But he's saying it's enough, you know, for him to survive. He feels good about it. Therefore, he doesn't feel any justification or any. He doesn't feel that he should be eating treif. A person. This is the Talmudic saying. A person should not. Switch to eating non-kosher food if heter food is available. So why, you know, rely on the non-kosher food when I have kosher food available for me?
But kosher food is not available. It's only available because he's in that position, and it's only in that position because the kappa put him there.
Right, but he's saying that I'm able to survive on the bread.
But only because he's in that position.
Right. But he's saying, I don't need to rely on the soup. The capo is saying, like, you know what, but you're going to die, and I don't want you to, you know, I don't want you to have to, I don't want to take this risk if you're not going to eat the soup, right? You should do everything you can. The doctor prescribed the soup. You should eat the soup.
But it's still the position that's keeping him there.
Yeah, absolutely. So he certainly, you know, I think you kind of get this tension here. And so if you remember, what was the rabbi's psak earlier, the same Rabbi Aronson, he said, you can eat the soup. So you can imagine what his response here. I think he certainly believes that bikaron, you know, you certainly are halachically justified to eat the soup. But Rabbi Aronson at the same time realizes, you know, at the same time, this individual doesn't want to eat the soup. It's hard to force someone to eat something which is not kosher, even if it's technically legally permitted. At the same time, you know, in our kishkas, it's hard to convince someone who's grew up, and this is, you know, like a very from Elcha, you know, Hungarian Jew, it's hard to convince them to all of a sudden do something which, you know, their whole life they stood against. They didn't eat non-kosher. So nimseti b'matzav mavich meod. I found myself in a very difficult situation. Lelo motza mamash. So I had really no good solution. So what did I do? Libesof achrei shidulim rabim b'sichot nifradot. After much and much discussion, and after, you know, taking each of the litigants aside and speaking to them privately, after really, really speaking to them and really trying to find a reconciliation between them, heini makapo veheini marav benifrad, hitzlachti lotzi miparav havtacha, shi'im matzav b'riyoto yora v'yelo storech b'riyuti bekach, hu mikabel atzmo lechol gamin maraka lo kasher. I got the Rabbi Roth to agree with me, to promise me that if his physical health were to deteriorate even slightly, then at that moment he would agree to indeed have the non-kosher soup. Ve'ilu hakapo oto yislach nishachnea ki yistapek behavtachat harav u'biprat amarti v'maseh atamatzila shalosh nefashot harav mivshnei benav kiyem hane'anim mikarim hem ochlim et harak hatref v'gam matzlachat chayem yesh lecha chilek. I, at the same time that I convinced, I made the Rabbi Roth promise me that if his health were to deteriorate even slightly, he would eat the soup. At the same time, I convinced, after much, you know, persuasion, after much coaxing, I convinced this capo to agree to keep the capo, to keep the rabbi along, to rely on his promise that indeed if his situation were to deteriorate, he would indeed eat the soup. And I also told this capo that you're not only doing it to save this one individual, this one rabbi, but you're also doing it to save his two children, because his two children are indeed eating the soup, and you're therefore saving not just one life, but actually three lives. And you're really doing, you know, big mitzvah in doing this. So he was indeed able to convince them. This took me a lot of time, and you can imagine from Rabbi Aronson's side, just in terms of getting perspective, he's exhausted, right? This is at the end of a very tiring day. I'm not sure exactly what his job was in the camp. I don't think it was as bad as the schlepping rocks, but it was certainly, you know, exhausting. He's not eating well. He's been in these camps for several years now, right? He can barely schlep. He can barely, you know, manage to get up on the bunk. He's older already. He can imagine, you know, his situation, and he's spending hours talking to these individuals, right, trying to convince them to, you know, in this insane situation of Auschwitz, you know, to convince them to, you know, manage together and survive. So finally, after much effort, Yitzhak Lishbor at the Kapo was able to break his resolve. I was able to convince him to let the this Jew survive. Mamash Shichnua Rav, Hishkati Bo, Ash Iskim Sha'er Bekomando Shelo, et the Rav Shivaitaiska. After much work, I was able to finally convince him. And I'll mention that it's worth, I think, in context to really appreciate the reason I quoted these two stories, these two tshuvas, is because I think you get the sense that on the one hand, right, Aaronson, you know, certainly feels himself, we've read earlier, he certainly felt that, you know, you were legally allowed to eat the non-kosher soup. In fact, he himself ate the non-kosher soup publicly, and he said he even made a bracha on it. But at the same time, he understands that even if you're technically allowed to do something, at the same time, it's hard to really convince someone who really feels in their kishkas that they don't want to do it. And this is something that, you know, from a historical perspective, happens all the time. You know, you tell someone that, you know, for whatever reason, you're allowed to eat on Yom Kippur. It sometimes is very hard, and this is, you know, it sometimes surprises people when they don't know this, but it's sometimes very hard to convince people to eat something on Yom Kippur because it just feels so wrong. How do you eat something on Yom Kippur? Even if the situation demands it. And it's why, actually, like, one of the things I was taught, actually, in Smicha many times was you really have to emphasize that it's not just, you know, you're allowed to eat something on Yom Kippur. It's actually a mitzvah. And if you don't do it, you're doing an avera. Because people have such a difficult time doing something that feels so unnatural to them. And
so
you can...
The Yom Kippur thing I know is that women are told to eat on Yom Kippur when they're pregnant.
Yeah, we can talk about pregnancy itself is a very complicated question about eating, not eating, but it's, but yeah, absolutely, this is a very difficult thing, you know, even if you're, you know, I think we often talk about, oh, once the rabbi gives a kula, people, we assume, automatically jump at it. It's not really true. There are a lot of people, you know, and I think most people, depending on the situation, who like the chumras. They live in the chumras. That's what they expect to do.
You said a list of people, that, older people that he called. But I also know my mother would always try and fast on Yom Kippur too, regardless of whatever you told her.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something very common.
For 2,000 years, women didn't eat when they were pregnant.
This is something very common. It's hard to convince people to get rid of the things that they feel so natural to them. Right? If you've always, you know, cooked the following certain way for Pesach, how are you going to convince someone, oh, by the way, like, that's a chumra, you don't need to do that? They're not going to change. Like, that's so hard to do because that's what you grew up with. Yeah.
Yeah, so my Orthodox obstetrician said to me, I hope you're not going to fast on Yom Kippur. So I said, why not? I fast on Tisha B'Av. So he said, it's very bad for the baby. It draws on ketones. So he said, and I think this is the halacha, go home every 3 hours and have a spoon of apple juice, which is not considered eating, but it gets some sugar into you.
Yeah, so there's different advice what to do if you're pregnant, but it certainly it's hard to even convince people. That's, and I think we kind of see in this tension, right, not just the technical psak, but really the pastoral considerations here that, you know, he's really juggling, you know, while he himself is, you know, emaciated, he's really juggling these different considerations, and he's really, you know, the horrors of the Holocaust. The story ends, unfortunately, on a rather sad note. Yeah. If you can even say that in this situation, such a thing sad, the whole thing is horrible. L'da'avoni ha'gadol, to my, you know, great sadness, hitmotei t'rav rata b'yom ha'shini shel mitzad ha'mavet m'fursam b'Auschwitz sh'erganu ha'sha'im v'rgamonim b'yanuar 1945. To my great sorrow, this Rabbi Roth, he ended up collapsing and dying during the death marches in January 1945 from Auschwitz. Harav Adin HaNefesh, this rabbi was, you know, a very sensitive soul. He was a sensitive individual, and Shelo Hurgal ben Masar Yitzchanik Hazeh b'tnaim kukach machridim, who was not used to such, you know, forced walking to such horrible situations, horrible conditions. Hitmotet v'nafal Hashem yikom damav. He collapsed, he fell, and he died, and may God revenge his death. Even though it had been true that in the camp itself he had survived, but the one, you know, if you can say this, positive note is that Shnei Banav Nishiru B'chayim, his two sons did live as well, so this kapo, you know. I don't know about that. But certainly the kapo certainly had some, I mean, I think he got some. I think the kapo honestly had, yeah. I think Kabam Shred Chilek Olam Met, even if the kids hadn't survived, just, you know, even for what he did.
Well, but you know, it's kind of sad, though. I mean, you didn't know at the time he was making the psak, deciding at the Din Torah, but had this Rabbi Roth been drinking the soup all the time, he would have been stronger and in better health, and maybe he would have survived the march. We don't know that.
Yeah.
He would have had a better shot at it because he would have been healthier.
Yeah, it's hard to know. It's like, you know, I don't know if it's only based on his soup.
Somebody who's in better nutritional shape has got a better chance to make it than somebody who's not, right? So, you know.
Yeah, but part of the death march also sounds like it's, I think a lot of it was psychological.
Right.
And it sounds like he might not have had the psychological makeup. Yeah, it's hard to know.
Situation again, assume there's going to be a death march.
Yeah. It's honestly, I think we're just not in a position to judge any of these, you know, obviously. And, yeah, I mean, obviously I know this is, you know, a tragic story, but I hope, you know, in learning this, we can not only see, like, the technical halachic side, but we see a little bit of the flavor, or the lack of flavor, of, you know, what it was like to be in those camps, and really, hopefully, you know, our learning, we can be some type of schutz, a merit for, you know, not just Rabbi Roth, but really all the individuals who perished and those who survived the horrors of the Holocaust. And may we remember them, you know, on Yom HaShoah and, you know, for generations.
It's really amazing to me. This cop could have just sent this guy back where we need this problem.
He's a hero from of the story.
He wanted a Din Torah so he could get a Pesach Halacha. That, to me, is unbelievably amazing.
Yeah, I think it's an incredible story, a horrible story at the same time. And it's, I think it's...
Well, listen, this is being a cop after the war, you know. A lot of people took their revenge. You know, like, yeah. This is a nice story.
Campo sounds like a very nice